Thanks. Talk about feeling like a fish out of water. I'm not at all a mathematician. I'm not an applied mathematician even. I'm simply an ocean mapper that got involved with a radical revolutionary change in technology. And the technology that I deal with are sonars. And that change in sonar technology radically changed the nature of the data that we receive at the end of our sonar string, and it increased it by orders of magnitude, and it kind of forced us to explore new ways to process and particularly to visualize, because this is spatial data, geospatial data. We're trying to map the seafloor and interact with those data. And what I'm going to describe is basically a series of tools that we've developed to do that, and I suspect this is going to be more like the cartoons for you guys. It's not going to be a mathematical exploration at all, but it's really going to look at what's at the end of the processing stream, incorporating some of the approaches that you guys developed, but maybe just give you a little hint at what's at the end of that world. What I want to do is start by just giving you a little background, because I suspect none of you have any idea about what ocean mapping is about. Describe the nature of the data we collect, and then basically just sit down and show you a bunch of examples that are really in the visualization world rather than the image processing world. So let me just start by saying people have been mapping the ocean for literally thousands of years. It's a statue taken from a tomb from 2000 BC, and sitting on the bow of that Egyptian vessel there is the old-fashioned ocean mapper with a hunk of lead at the end of a rope. And his job was to toss it out ahead of the boat to make sure that they didn't run aground, and in doing it was able to measure. So 2000 BC already they were mapping. The next picture I was able to find comes from 1450, the Thames River. Same technique, hunk of lead at the end of a rope, measuring the depth. But if I jump about 500 years or so, and we see the technique, we see that it didn't change a bit. So basically, for 4,000 years, the only way to measure the depth of the ocean was with a hunk of lead at the end of a rope. Then, during the Second World War, sonars were perfected. We were able to send time, measure the travel time of sound bouncing off the seafloor. If you have an idea of the speed of sound in the water column, you can estimate the depth. The sonar, what we call the single beam sonar that was developed then, spreads in a spherical sense. It insonifies a large area of the seafloor all at once with its wavefront. We get back only a single return, and we can only assume that that return comes from the position of the vessel, despite the fact that it'll come from the shoalest point anywhere in that area of insonification, which can be on the order of the depth of the water. So if you're in 3,000, 4,000 meters of water, you get one depth somewhere in a circle that's 3 or 4 kilometers.
And why can't they collimate?
At that time they couldn't, but what's happened indeed over the last, take a step back from that, which really brought us up till about the 1970s, that was the only technique, they then developed, we'd get a very two-dimensional picture, they then developed an approach that, again, take a step back to show you the products that come from this single beam and lead line. About 90% of all the data we have on our charts these days are still a combination of single beam sonar and lead line data. Produce a bathymetric chart for shallow water, and for deep water, basically somebody's imagination connecting the discrete dots of these measurements. You can see the ship tracks, a contour map. And so that was the level of our ability to map the seafloor at that time. And now coming to the big advancement, which was this ability to collimate the sound, or actually beamform, the idea was instead of taking a large single transducer to create a long array, the array has some directionality, not just take a single array, take two arrays, cross Mills Cross or Mills T, and beamform. And again, it basically just had to keep up with the processing technology, mostly electronics at first analog and then digital. And then finally, by about the late 70s, the technique was developed originally just to create a single narrow beam, and as it evolved, to create multiple beams. Where's that dangerous pointer? Transmit, very narrow in the fore-aft direction, wide because you have a long array in this direction. Receive, just the opposite. You have an array that's long in this direction, and that was the one that beamforms, so multiple receive arrays. So your receive array has a series of beams. The intersection of the two, cross product, mathematical as I'll get, gives us discrete measurements on the seafloor. So we can now multiply make hundreds, literally, and there are a number of different systems, so different scales, as with all acoustics, it's all scalable, high frequency, high resolution, low frequency, long range, long resolution, but we get literally hundreds of measurements with very high lateral resolution, high vertical resolution simultaneously as the vessel traverses.
Well, what is the state of the art in terms of resolution now?
The state of the art is, I'll give it in a percentage because it's always a percentage of the depth because the frequency scales. It's typically about a tenth of a percent in terms of vertical resolution, and in terms of horizontal resolution, the footprint size, the best systems are about a half degree now in terms of the footprint on the seafloor. So that's something like 1% of the water depth in terms of lateral resolution. I'll show you some examples in a few minutes where we're resolving 2 to 3 centimeter ripples on the seafloor, but that's in shallow water. In deep water, we resolve features that are a few meters in dimension, but even that's a remarkable change. Okay, so we've gone from this single beam that gives us a series of discrete points that were made, collected, usually widely spaced, somebody interpolated between the two, to this complete coverage. And indeed, each one of these points represents one of the discrete footprints. And so again, it's really radically changed the nature of the data that we have to deal with. And it's allowed us to go from views of the seafloor that are like this in shallow water, views that are like this, and this is basically the process and the tools that I'll be talking about, our transformation from that to that kind of view in an interactive mode. And for the deep sea floor, a view off Southern California here, and a view like this, which again, of course, gives us some remarkable new insight into processes, which is we as ocean scientists are interested in deriving. We paid a price for that, and if we look at in 100 meters of water, which is kind of an intermediate depth, a team with a lead line can make maybe 10 measurements in an hour. The single beam echo sounder gives about 22,000 measurements in that same hour, if we think about megabytes of data per hour on this column. And then several generations of these multi-beam sonars that have increased by an order of magnitude the data density. And then finally, in the latest generation, systems that can move very, very rapidly, we're talking about in 100 meters of water, 1.5 million soundings an hour, about 80 megabytes of data an hour. An hour. If we speed that up, and when we get in shallow water, we can speed up the repetition rate because the sonar still needs to wait for the last ping to come from the furthest out beam. We can get data rates of something like 30 million soundings an hour, a gigabyte of data an hour. A new generation that now can use swept frequency, FM encoded pulses to put multiple pings in the water at a time, give us about 300 million soundings an hour, about 10 gigabytes an hour. And at the very end of the talk, if I get a chance, we're now starting to, these original systems were all designed absolutely from the ground up to lock and track the bottom. And they wanted to dismiss anything in the water column. The new systems now are actually allowing us to capture information in the water column too. And we're talking about a gigabyte a minute in terms of data. And so again, a challenge to what we do with that data, how we interpret it. And again, it's spatial data. And how we interact with it.
So it's variations in the density? What's being measured in that last one?
Well, in the water column, it's the same thing. It's a time of flight. Sound will continue to propagate until it hits a change in the acoustic impedance, which is the density and the sound speed of the serial. Okay. So if there's something in the water column, it could be a different water mass, it could be a fish. The seafloor is a very good change in acoustic impedance, and then it will bounce back. And fundamental measurement is a kind of flight measurement, but as I'll show you, we've also evolved into making an amplitude measurement from that too. So we get what we call the backscatter also. So we get time of flight, distance, and backscatter as another variable. Okay, suddenly going from a discrete measurement here to a discrete measurement there, you folks know much better than I do, to a situation where in some spatial error that we have redundancy in our measurements, the first time ever we have had redundancy, has certainly increased the precision and our ability to measure uncertainty. For the first time in the history of ocean mapping, we actually can produce a depth measurement that has an uncertainty value associated with it. And that's gone into a lot of development we've done in terms of automated processing algorithms. From the perspective of what I'm going to talk about here, the data density allows us to visualize and quantitatively explore the data in a series of new ways. And that's what I want to sit down and I'm just going to sit. And I'm just going to show you a sequence of examples of what we're doing. And if this plants a seed and has some relevance to what you're doing, all the better. If not, it'll just be a few minutes of not too much strain on you all. So let me just come out of here, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with, interestingly enough, the best global data set we have for deep sea bathymetry does not come from sonars at all, but it comes from satellite measurements of sea surface topography. The bathymetry of the seafloor, the ridges and the trenches in the bottom of the ocean, change the gravity signal and actually affect at a scale of, well, kind of on the minimum side of several kilometers to a maximum size of about 150 kilometers because we have isostatic compensation, affect the presence of the seafloor. A seamount will have a gravitational attraction. A trench will actually displace the gravity vectors. And so the sea surface actually reflects or mirrors the topography over the scale range. And satellite altimetry can track that, and there's been a series of algorithms developed that allow the transformation of sea surface altimetry into bathymetry, and we call it the predicted bathymetry. It only has a resolution of about two nautical miles spacing, so it's very coarse resolution. Imagine a map of this area with one point every two miles wouldn't be terribly detailed, but it's certainly the most detailed information we have about the ocean. So that data set represents about 186 million points, and let me just extract a little piece of it to just go through the most primitive visualization we do, and just introduce you to some of the aspects of what we do. This is predicted topography. I'll extract a piece from about 40 north, 20 north, 10 west, 140 west, and I'll select every point. So it's about, you know, see, 700 by 900 points for a small data set. Just bring it on here and call it. And basically, in this case, the data set started out as equal space points, a digital train model equal spacing. We could also take in points that often come from our sonars, which are not equal space, and create a TIN, a train network. We bring in the grid of points. Color map quickly helps us look at it. I've actually got a color map that's designed specifically for this data set that puts a zero at a major change in color, so we can see the coastlines. I have both land and sea in this data set continuously. And then bring in a series of lighting models that allow us to change the ambient light level, the specular component of the lighting model, and most importantly, the Lambertian components to allow us to create shadows. And we also, in this approach, calculate true soft shadows. So not just occlusion, but actually give a gradient to the shadows. So I do that. I choose a sun illumination direction. I can choose a sun height. The idea is just to find a very rapid way to get this data set into a way we can interact with it. I render that, and I get a pseudo 3D image. I'll save that. I'll assemble that into a world that I can interact with that in 3D. Do that, and then bring that into the 3D world here. And now I've added perspective, interactivity, and the ability to manipulate the data in terms of zooming. It's fully georeferenced. We maintain the georeference information you can see as up here any time, the latitude, longitude, and depth. And of course, we can interrogate the data in terms of scaling and profiles and things like that. So the interactivity allows us this way to explore these massive data sets in a pretty natural and intuitive way. One of the problems we run into right away in the tools we saw around in exploring these data sets is that it always demanded a single scale of gridding. And yet, we run sonars that go from very high frequency and very high resolution to the very low frequency or the lowest frequency with satellite altimetry, with 2 mile data spacing, when we have sonars also that can display data at meters of resolution. And the question was how to do that, and again, by sticking into the 3D world and basically just treating each data set as an independent object and mapping it to the Z buffer, we were able to then, let me bring up a new call scene. We were then able to combine data sets and maintain each data set at its inherent level of resolution. So I've got a gaudy, another one of these predicted topography data sets. This is off the coast of Nova Scotia. But what I'll do here is now bring in an independent data set. This was a data set that has 1 kilometer resolution. I've colored it differently. I could color it so it would blend. I want to show the differences, but the ability to maintain each data set at its independent level of resolution. In this area, one of those multi-beam surveys was done. Here's a data set now, so I've gone from 2 mile to 1 kilometer, excuse the mix of units, to now 20 meter pixel resolution. You can see, of course, the detail now that's increased. But an even higher resolution sonar was used here that now has 2 meter pixel resolution. And I'll zero in on that data set. And this was an exploration of a wreck. This is a wreck of a World War II frigate that was developed. And the interesting thing is that I go back to the 20 meter pixel resolution, and I remove that wreck, the high resolution survey, you can still see a hint of it there. But you never would have found it unless you knew it was there. This way it sticks out very clearly. And so the point here is that by using this environment and having independent objects, mapping each to its space, its position in space, we can seamlessly move from many, many scales of resolution without having to worry about regridding all at a single scale. If we look at the nature of this wreck, this is, as I said, a 2 meter resolution. There's been a very interesting new development in the sonar world, and that's something called dynamically focused sonars. Sonars suffer when you're in the near field of having a nonlinear, a range of nonlinear effects. So if you want to really build a high frequency sonar with a very narrow, very high resolution, lateral resolution, you kind of have a catch-22 that the near field extends beyond the range of the sonar. So recently, there's been a development of a focused multi-beam sonar. And let me bring up an example of what happens when we look at a wreck through that. And if I do that, this is a World War I wreck off of Scapa, in the Orkney Islands. Scapa Flow, the German fleet scuttled its entire World War I fleet at the end of the war. They interpreted the armistice a little differently than the British interpreted and ordered the fleet sunk after the armistice was signed. But you see now with this dynamically focused sonar, we can even see plates and portholes on this wreck. And this is in, if you can read up here, 32 meters of water. You can see here great damage to the wreck. That's not from the scuttling. The vessels were scuttled by just sinking them gently. This is from salvage that's been going on over the years, and that's because this is pre-nuclear, airborne nuclear testing steel. So it's extremely valuable for building any instrument that has a zero background, radioactive background. So it's a tremendous industry in salvaging the steel.
Say that again.
It was built before any airborne testing of nuclear devices, so the steel has zero radioactive background. Any steel that's made post-airborne testing will have some level of radioactive material. Now, something I wouldn't have thought of either. It was quite intriguing. And at 32 meters, which is at the limit of divers, safe diver depth, there have been a number of accidents, and so these surveys have been going on. One of the problems you see with this approach, and our approach here is basically to form a grid, create platelets, calculate the normal to the platelets, calculate a viewer perspective, give the surface a texture to the Lambertian model, calculate what's occluded, then create shadows. If we have 2 points at one at the same XY position with different heights, we have a real problem because we're basically draping over the surface to create the color map. So you see here, these are cranes and things on the wreck that are very difficult to discern. And I'll come back in a minute and show you how we handle it.
Are those vertical reaches now horizontal?
This piece here?
Yeah.
Ocean mappers in training here, those are actually artifacts. The vessel itself is moving quite a bit. We have a very expensive inertial motion system on there to measure heat, pitch, and roll. If it's not perfectly compensated for, we leave an artifact. Those artifacts, you'll see, are, that's fine. So they're about 10 centimeters in height. With the sun illumination, it looks very corrugated. I'll show you some we've been able to. This was an early survey that we didn't do a perfect job on. I'll show you some we've done almost a perfect job of removing that. But that inertial system is about a $225,000 to $250,000 system.
that's added onto the sonar, just a very accurate measure of heave, pitch, and roll. What you're seeing there is a heave artifact.
How about the pink on top versus the blue?
The pink on top, it's a color map. So if you look at the depth up there, that's 34 meters. If you look at the blue over here, that's 33 meters. If I throw a contour on there, so if I show, put a contour on there, if I pick, say, 33 meters or something, minus, because we can treat depths as minus. You'll see it's basically a depth contour. It's getting deeper, so the color is mapped to depth. And you see the effect of this, yeah?
What is this black region?
That's
is that you didn't get a reflection?
It's a shadow, yeah. This is a single pass of the sonar system.
Yes.
The sonar is actually coming through here, and so that area there is in shadow. I can show you later some examples where we go on both sides, and if our positioning is very, very tight, and we try to position within a few centimeters with something I'll call kinematic GPS positioning, we can then match it to see all sides of it, and I'll show you examples. But right now that's a shadow because this is, represents only a single pass. Actually, let me show you an example of that, of what happens now if we do multiple passes and navigate it very well. This is a survey we did a couple of years ago off Normandy, the D-Day beaches of Normandy, and there's lots of questions about what happened to the state of the material there. And these are what we'll call the Mulberry Harbors, the caissons. So these are cement caissons, about 80 meters long, that were floated over and then sunk in place to create an artificial harbor, and then were destroyed 2 weeks after the invasion during a very, very large storm, which actually lifted up, there's a ship, you can see that it was lifted up and dropped on top of the caissons during the storm, that storm that destroyed about 800 ships and the artificial harbor, but by that time the Allies had taken shelter and had other ways to supply themselves. But here you see, if I come back, you can see the swath width, the single swath is that large. You see still a tiny bit of that artifact. This time it's very, very small. This time it's less than, it's half a centimeter. So they're just a couple of centimeters, those artifacts. But now there's no shadow because we've been able to combine coverage from all sides. And I have one line here with a single line. You see it's a little crisper because there's no degradation now in terms of positional smear of where those points in the digital train model are. So it's a little crisper, but we don't get both. Here we still get the shadow. So that's a single pass. And then see multiple passes. Okay. Now to come back to this idea of wrecks and what happens with overhangs, let me go to another place on Normandy. And take a look at a series of tanks. The invasion was led by a series of tanks that were amphibious. They're called DD tanks, dual duplex. The idea was they had a large canvas curtain around them that displaced enough water to allow them to float. That was the idea. It didn't work, unfortunately. 33 of the first 36 all sank. And there's been tremendous controversy over them. They asked us to find them. They were easy to find. That looks like a tank. You see scour around the tank sitting out there. There's several more in this line. But the question is which way they were facing. And because there's a big argument between the Allies, the British who designed it said that the Allies had turned them sideways and that's why they sank, and the Allies said that they were driving straight, it was just a bad design. Or the Americans said that. So what we want to do is, how do we get over that overhang business? So what we've done is create a way now that we can actually extract the points in the 3D world. So I'm going to do that and actually drill down to the individual points. And if I extract the points themselves, and again maintain the 3D environment, yeah, and each one pointing directly towards the beach, that doesn't work just like a Sherman tank. So this is now we're talking about a 9-centimeter gun barrel that we're resolving with the sonar. This is one of these dynamically focused sonars. But this is also a way, in any erection situation, to try to get around this idea of an overhanging surface in terms of visualizing the points, multiple points at one XY position.
Okay, each case here, I've basically just been talking about this travel time data. I'm going to bring up one more data set. In this case, where we've combined both a land-based data set and an offshore data set. This is Oahu. You see Diamond Head over here. And this is data that comes from the USGS topographic data with about a 30-meter pixel size. And here's the bathymetry going from about 40 meters to about 600 meters offshore. For years, they've been dredging in Pearl Harbor here and dumping offshore, and we were asked to map that dredging material, but there is absolutely no vertical expression of it. It's spread out thin enough that we can't resolve that with the sonar in terms of travel time. And now I want to add this extra dimension, this backscatter information, and this is a mosaic. You can see the passes, multiple, you've got a little artifact at NATO where we have no side scan information, it's a side scan sonar. It's the same sonar, just taking the amplitude information. Now, with a grayscale colored map to the amplitude, and we can see each individual dump site and the nature. Sometimes they jump them from a barge, but we can also see where they run the conveyor belt, even 500-600 meters of water. So this backscatter has a whole new dimension, making at least a connection to your last talk. I should say that one of our researchers has been how we each one of these backscatter images is a long series of grayscale pixels that overlap and have all kinds of ambiguities in terms of position. We try to resolve those as best possible. But the key is to make as coherent a mosaic as possible, and the graph cut method is being applied to that, and with some success. One of the issues here, though, is that to do this, what I've done now is taken each pixel of bathymetry, and this is 20-meter resolution on the seafloor, and taken a pixel of this backscatter and color mapped that pixel with the backscatter amplitude in grayscale to two separate images that you see. The interesting thing is that the backscatter actually has much higher lateral resolution than the bathymetry. Every time you send one of those beams of sound down, there's one depth that comes back, but hundreds of backscatter values can come back because it's a time series across the footprint as opposed to just the time of flight of the sender of the beam. And so we're losing a lot of resolution. And so using this approach, the best we can do is resample the bathymetry at that high resolution, wasting tons of memory, or degrade the backscatter to the resolution of the bathymetry, as we've done here. Unless we introduce texture mapping, which we've done now, and here I now can introduce a much higher resolution texture map of the backscatter, which has opened up a great new world for us and something we can take advantage of because of the graphics engines and these little laptops. Before, this would take several $100,000 SGI to do. I used to have to march around with that. But now, on a little laptop, we can just take advantage of the hardware texture mapping and create a much, much higher resolution image that's co-registered with the bathymetry.
By backscatter, you mean time reversal filter?
No, by backscatter here, I mean basically a time series of the amplitude of the sound across the seafloor.
So you never use the time reversal in order to clean up the aberrations?
Not in this. I think maybe our next speaker, who's going to talk about more seismic, he's here. In the seismic world, they use time reversal quite a bit, and in the water column work they do. But we've not applied it yet to see.
Are these the best images you have, or the best images you can show us?
That's a very fair question. These are about the best images that we created with this system. Again, every system has a different scale. This is a 30 kilohertz system, so it has a finite resolution. And this is about the best. The key is the mosaic. It's how well you can blend it. Because remember, each one is created individually. So a lot of success is not in the initial sonar, but in the ability to process the data and take out a whole range of artifacts that are here and then blend it together in a coherent fashion. What's happening, these holes were very unnatural. If we look at the original mosaic, which was at its 20-meter pixel resolution, nobody understood. They thought they had broken up an old hospital in Honolulu after the war and sent these big hunks of concrete off over that area. And it's thought that these were scour features around them, but they couldn't see the blocks. But this is 20-meter pixel resolution. When we put in the texture map resolution, you actually can see the individual blocks. So again, it's adding this wonderful new dimension, which has really helped us in a range of other applications, mostly in an area that's a very large growth area in terms of what we're doing, which is fisheries habitat. We're actually required by law now to map
areas of essential fish habitat, and the bathymetric mapping is probably not enough. And so here, if we come, to where I live, Portsmouth Harbor, bathymetric chart I showed you before, but now we can take georeference. These are video mosaics. Mosaics are videos that we send up our graduate students down with cameras and swim back and forth and track them, and then we mosaic those and georeference them. But now if I take a look at these large sand waves that we knew all about in the harbor, when we look at the video scale of imagery, we see that there are tiny ripples that are orthogonal to the, something we didn't know about, something that very much affects our interpretation of the backscatter. If we come out to a rock outcrop, I can tell it's a rock outcrop here, but that's about all I can tell about it. But now with the texture mapping, the video imagery on top, I can get down to the resolution of the starfish, and that's really what we're aiming at home in terms of habitat.
But that's video.
That's video, yeah. Right, yeah. Now I'm going to show you our approach to that in terms of multi-beam, coming back to coming back to the focus sonars. This is not a focus sonar, but here we now, this is a Navy experiment. We're again strictly sonar. We're looking for mines. You can see very clearly each one of these mines. I'll show you a picture of what it looks like. Each one dimensionally correct, including several. These are supposedly stealth mines, a manta mine and a rock can mine, that are only 40 centimeters or so in dimension total, and supposedly designed so that it can't be discerned, but the focus side scan certainly.
Where is this?
Wait, yeah. Is that classified?
No. This is actually off Martha's Vineyard. It was a Navy experiment. These are all inert mines.
Oh, so these were planted?
These are planted, yeah. Right.
Navy does mining experiments off of Martha's Vineyard?
Because they wanted, there are many analogies to the areas of Martha's Vineyard to other areas that are of greater interest. So they wanted a very dynamic, an area with dynamic sand. And so that's what that mine looks like. And there we can see the acoustic effect of the three rings, or acoustics of the optical sensors on it. The same sonar coming back to the ripples.
Do you have your thing strong enough that you can detonate it?
That's always a possibility. This was an experiment to understand the variable behavior of the mines, not in a mine detection approach, because if you're trying to detect mines, you have to go over it, as the sonar has to do, it's too late. And it becomes a mine neutralization experiment, not a mine detection experiment. You need a sonar that's going to look far away.
Right.
And then if it detonates, it's okay. But here we're looking at ripples that are just 2 to 3 centimeters. So we are getting to that level of resolution. What we now can do with the texture mapping is now change we can now use that kind of texture mapped image and treat it in a totally different way. And here we're creating a vertical profile with the image. We're actually using on our vessel, we're using a camera, again, GPS navigated and positioned. Here I'm combining this with some aerial photography. But now we can take a vertical curtain, in essence. And so as we come, again, all georeference, as we come steaming by, we can now see the extent of the shore. And I'll show you an example where we put that into a chart product that allows us to predict, or allows us to navigate, basically, if it's nighttime or foggy or whatever. This is now being replaced with a laser scanner that gives us a range measurement at the same time and a three-dimensional view that we're building into the scene too. We can extend this now in terms of, I said if I have time, I'd get to time. I'll start with geologic time, because in a geologic sense, the fourth dimension is below the seafloor, the time dimension. Here we have, this is actually collected by an autonomous vehicle in the Gulf of Mexico for bathymetry. Very strange features on the seafloor, so they collected a sub-bottom image, used lower frequency sound, and we now can create a vertical curtain that allows us to see basically back in geologic time, and the correlation of these features on the surface with what are clearly faults in the subsurface. So we're adding that third dimension now. We can also add an interpretive capability. Allows us to look into boreholes and put the interpretive product in that same environment. So now again, using, in this case, aerial photography, the subsurface, and now interpretive products and the borehole. Like I said, we talked about tsunamis, and Fred will talk about that. This is work that I've not done, but colleagues at Scripps have done, using the same approach of interactive visualization and 3D, and took a look at the seismic events surrounding the December earthquake in Sumatra, now color-coded by depth, position, and magnitude, all again in a geospatial framework.
And this data is collected how?
These are seismometers, global seismometers that report position and amplitude, and any other input that they get, whatever position, it just needs a position and depth, epicenter depth. All I've shown you now is just about the geospatial data, but we have started to bring in the time dimension, and the time dimension really started with our work with Frederick when we were on a cruise where he was modeling the tsunami and would provide for us a series of alpha products of the model. And I don't know if we'll describe the model at all, but basically a series of gridded products at time increments based on the best estimate of the bathymetry at the time, and their understanding of the earthquake mechanisms. And so what we started with is the bathymetry. Frederick then provides us a series of time steps that's, you'll see that as I move, it moves. Let me make that somewhat transparent.
So that's the seafloor?
That's the seafloor and the sea surface both. I've basically taken two DTMs. The seafloor DTM, which is static.
Okay.
Here's the seafloor DTM, and I've made it transparent so you can see it. Then the water surface DTM, which are the time steps that Frederick provides. It's loaded down now. Going through, and these are 5-minute intervals. And we'll see the first. But now we allow interactivity. There's the initial break, the ground motion, and the spreading of the wave. So we can explore this at any scale we want. And if I flip these over here, we can also keep track of the profile of the surface itself and actually compare it to some satellite altimetry data, which is a very experimental data.
What is the distance scale that we're looking at here?
You can measure that off here. So that line I drew was 1,250 kilometers.
What are these waves propagating?
This is the tsunami itself. So what you see there is the, when you can come back, I'll stop it.
So where were the precursors? I'm sorry.
As best guess, at least at this time, and Frederick might want to comment more, is there were four breaks. The fault propagated. This is an area where the Indian Ocean plate is subducting the Sumatra.
They're supposed to be precursors, right? And postcursors.
No, this is now, this is not the seismic wave, this is the sea surface wave. And what you're seeing is the actual break, which took over, what was it, 1,000 kilometers? And
yeah, 1,000 kilometers, about 10 minutes.
10 minutes. When the big rupture went, it broke in four pieces, those are the four pieces, and then this is now the result of the displacement of the seafloor propagating to the sea surface, and what that wave looks like propagating along.
And how is that measured?
How is, which?
Was it measured?
Frederick will talk about that. This is a model. This is a model that Frederick used. But what? So one of the constraints was run-up. It's constrained by run-up around measured in all the towns, and there is measurement with a sea surface altimeter too of the wave passing by. But do you want to comment on the model itself?
Well, I would say a few words and then we'll talk.
Okay. So Frederick will talk about that Wednesday.
Yes.
Wednesday. 2 minutes. Okay. Good. That's what I thought. Okay, so I want to, the last 2 minutes, just step into the time dimension. And this one I'm not brave enough to run live because it takes a lot of code to load up. But what we're now doing is trying to extend this approach to zooming in both time and space. And so here is an example where we're using those vertical curtains. We have a 3D seafloor. But if you see down here, same interactivity in terms of zooming in space, but we can also zoom through time. And so the idea is to have any kind of environment where you have a time-varying data set and a spatially varying data set that allows you to manipulate it anywhere in there. One example of this is a series of tags that have been put on whales. They actually measure the motion of the whale. And in that same environment, if this will run, we can now track multiple whales that are being tagged. It should come up. There we go. And we create something we call space-time notes. So any place you need to go in the spatial or temporal domain, you can zoom to right away. So here again, these are not animations. These are, although it appears as an animation, all real tracking of the vessels and tracking of the whales. So this motion is all real. We're seeing all kinds of unique behavior we haven't seen before. But we'll speed up time to get to an interesting point.
Do you have anything in the Sacramento Delta?
Yeah, not yet. this was an interesting issue. Interesting issue because they, for the first time, had two whales tagged together. These circles they make are called bubble curtains. They go down and they blow a series of bubbles around a bunch of feed, smaller fish, and then they swim through it. They actually create a net, a curtain that attracts them. And then they wanted to know if they were collaborating, but it turns out they weren't. This near one was doing all the work, the other one was mooching. And they found out the near one was the male, of course. This was the female doing the work, it was the male doing all the mooching. And then just end up with, as I said, we're starting to now collect this gigabyte of data an hour in the water column. And so now our challenge is real-time visualizing that data set, which has been a number of interesting challenges in terms of target detection and signal to noise, and we benefit much from the kind of work you do. The sonar manufacturer provides you a display that looks something like this. You're looking at the seafloor, but we see targets in there, and the question is what in the world they are. They're very ephemeral in that display, and so our challenge has been to see something running by. Is that a whale? Is that a seal? Or whatever. It'll just turn around, and then I'll stop it and one more on. And it turns out these were fishnets, and so this is our goal, to handle a gigabyte of data a minute and be able to render this in as near real time as possible. But, just if there are questions, what I'll do in the last...
What is your estimate of the redundancy of this data set, i.e. the sparsity of it?
Yeah, the redundancy is easy to calculate.
Yeah, if you just cut out half the number of bits and the quarter and an eighth and 16th, mm-hmm. how much of the features would you be able to recover?
Depends on the size of the feature, basically. Okay. And we can calculate the number of hits that we see, and that's indeed one of the approaches we've been taking to try to optimize the display, is how much can we reduce it. We're actually using a lot of imagery reduction, just trying to turn this into JPEGs and things like that. Actually helped tremendously in terms of the actual, what we get our XYZs coming out of the sonar at a gigabyte a minute. And turning them into images and using the kind of stuff you guys are doing is really helpful. The final challenge we're having is 3D flow. And I'll just let that run, where we have a global circulation model.
and trying to explore ways to basically see many, many layers through the water column.
Okay, great.
Thank you.